the idea of reward and punishment with the next subtopic that I wanted to discuss, and that is the various kinds of punishment that one could receive in this world or the next world for various different kinds of sins. I want to start, I hope we won't use the whole shiur for this, but it really doesn't make that much of a difference, with something from last week's Sedra, because it is relevant to this topic of reward and punishment. And that is understanding the mass punishment of the flood. Because the flood did not only affect human beings. Most of the world was destroyed, except for Noah and his family. But it wasn't only the world of human beings. All the animals, except those saved in the Teva, were destroyed. Not only animals, all vegetation was destroyed. And the rabbis say even the first three tefachim, the first 9 to 12 inches of topsoil, was also totally obliterated and destroyed. How do you understand that? Why was the world punished? Only human beings who have free choice, if there's free choice, there's reward and punishment. If there's no free choice, why should someone be rewarded or punished for something they had no choice about doing? So, the Beis HaLevi says the following. He says that it's not that the animals and plants and soil were punished. But since man, and you can't even say, just as an aside, that the reason everything was destroyed because they were created for the sake of man. And if man is destroyed, then there's no purpose for them anymore. That would have applied if all human beings would have been destroyed. But there were human beings left, so why not leave all these things to serve Noah? So, the Beis HaLevi says, it wasn't a punishment that the animals and trees and ground were destroyed, but it was because man had such an influence over creation that because he did things that were so perverse and so distorted, they basically polluted the world spiritually. And because the world was polluted, it says the animals intermated, which wasn't natural to them. They killed each other. They also practiced chamas. They also practiced terrifying each other, which wasn't natural to many of them. It's because man influenced them. Man's actions had the power to pollute the entire world, and therefore it had to be destroyed. They were contaminated. We know today that that's the case. Man, through his physical pollution, can do things that make the world destroyed, that destroy the water supply, destroy animals and plants, and even the soil. Because of man's physical sins, not spiritual sins. So just the way that physical things can pollute the world, spiritual things can pollute the world too. And I was thinking to add to that, when something becomes tummy, and it needs, the whole world became tummy, what's the normal way of transforming something tummy into tahar? By putting it in a mikveh. So therefore, the flood was a mikveh that immersed the entire world in those waters that purified the world from the tumah, from the pollution, spiritual pollution, that man caused. And that's why the flood waters lasted for 40 days, because the number 40 is significant to a mikveh. 40 saw of water. You need 40 measures of a saw each to make a mikveh kosher, and therefore the flood had a connection to the number 40. So that was the idea. It wasn't a punishment to the inanimate objects or the plants or the animals. It was a natural result of man's affecting the world in a negative way, and therefore the world became contaminated and polluted and had to be destroyed. And a new world had to come up, and that's why the animals that were able to remain pure, not because of their free choice, were the ones that were saved. And that's also why the fish weren't destroyed, because the fish were separated from human beings in their own mikveh, and man couldn't contaminate and pollute them. They were separated from man. They were in the mikveh itself. So therefore, the fish didn't have to be destroyed. Okay, yes.
Okay. If all the vegetation was destroyed, where did the olive tree come from that the dust brought the branch back?
So the Chazal say that he took it from Eretz Yisrael, or from Gan Eden. And not that there was walls around Gan Eden or Eretz Yisrael that didn't let the water in, but the waters didn't fall in Eretz Yisrael or Gan Eden. They weren't turbulent and boiling. They just receded from the rest of the world by natural gravity. So the flood in Eretz Yisrael wasn't as destructive as it was in the rest of the world, and therefore the vegetation survived. And it could be the vegetation in Eretz Yisrael and Gan Eden wasn't affected and polluted by man's deeds, because the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael and the Kedusha of Gan Eden saved them. The influence the other way was stronger. The Beis Halevi, Yosef Dov Halevi Salavechik, not the one who recently passed away in our generation, but three generations ago. Lachora not. Probably not. Yes.
Would you relate the period of the flood to the period of the dinosaurs?
I don't know. I wasn't there, so I really can't.
That totally extends the whole.
I don't know. The dinosaurs, some people say, were the Taninim Hagdolim that God created and killed off the female, salted her for the future world, and the males died off. So there was some kind of species that was created, big animals, Taninim Hagdolim, that died off. Maybe that's the dinosaurs. I don't know. Okay, in any case, so that was the punishment, or the non-punishment, of things that didn't have free choice that died during the flood. Now, I want to speak about something else related to that. In the end, God made a bris with the world. He made a covenant. And he gave a sign to the covenant, which was the rainbow, that there never would be another flood to destroy the entire world. There could be floods to destroy parts of the world. And there have been many floods, tsunamis, and so on. But to destroy the entire world would never again be destroyed by a flood. And Chazal say that includes any kind of flood. Not only not a flood of water, not a flood of fire, there'll never be total destruction of the world again because of the sins of man. Now that needs explanation. How could God make such a promise? If people would come to the level where the world deserved to be destroyed again, then why wouldn't God destroy it? That's not justice. And if God could overlook destroying the world when it deserves it, then why didn't he overlook it the first time? Why the first time around did he destroy the world? Why couldn't he have been merciful as he said he would be the second time that the world will deserve to be destroyed, and he won't destroy the entire world? Why couldn't he do that the first time? So if God could make such a promise, even if the world deserved to be destroyed, then why didn't he do that the first time? Why only after the first destruction? And if we're talking that the world won't deserve to be destroyed, then we need a promise for it. It doesn't deserve to be destroyed. Why would God destroy it if it doesn't deserve it? That's the question. Just as an aside, because it's also relevant. I wasn't going to speak about it, but it just popped into my mind I should say something about it. What did it mean that man, in fact, you know what, I'll save it for the end because it fits in to what I'm going to tell you at the end. So remind me that I said I'm going to tell you something at the end that I just thought of. Because by that time I'll probably forget it. So what does that mean? What does it mean that God promised he would not destroy the world again? And if he could break such a promise, why didn't he do it the first time? So a simple answer could be, deeper answer, but a simple answer could be that God could have done that the first time around. But he wanted to leave a warning, a deterrent for all time, that people see what could happen because of their deeds. So the first time around, he destroyed the world, which deserved to be destroyed, except for Noah, and rebuilt it. And he reminds us, when the time comes that we may deserve it again, he won't do it, but we should realize how serious what we are doing is, because really, that's what we deserve. So after the first time, God had that to use as a deterrent, as an incentive for all future generations. Had he never destroyed the world, people would have said, it never will happen. Can't happen. It's not so serious what we do. Here they saw once in history how serious it is, and for all of history, that was enough of a lesson for the future. Therefore, God said, it's not going to be necessary for me to destroy the world again, because I can use that first flood as the deterrent, as the warning, as the sign of how serious man's actions are, and therefore, from now on, I can have Rachmanis. Okay, I have a much deeper answer. We'll get to that at the end, and then I'll add in what I wanted to add in. Okay.
When the Shem promised never to destroy the world with any kind of flood, does that include what man does himself by atomic warfare?
I'm not sure. It says God won't bring a flood. If man decided to everybody leave their faucets on and flood the world, right? I'm not sure if they could be successful or not. God just promised he will not destroy the world because of the evil of man. That was the promise. Not that the world can't be destroyed by man. So I don't know if that's included or not. Okay, so let's start with a different discussion. What is the sign that God will not destroy the world? The rainbow. Now, how is the rainbow a sign and a sign to this covenant that there won't be a future destruction by a flood? So first of all, we have to ascertain whether the rainbow was created especially to be this sign, or it's a natural phenomenon, and if it is, then how could it be a sign that there won't be a flood? Now, it seems scientifically that a rainbow is a natural phenomenon, because you can make your own rainbow, right? You can shine light through a prism, which is basically what the water vapor forms, with the sunlight going through it, and it breaks the light into its seven wavelengths, red, orange, yellow, blue, green, indigo, and violet, right? Roy G. Biv. I learned something in high school. that was about it. In any case, so you can do that artificially. And we know that's the way that rainbows are made. So if rainbows are a natural phenomenon, they must have existed since the beginning of the world. So what does it mean that God now made this rainbow into a sign? So there are two opinions amongst the Rishonim. The Ibn Ezra, it's interesting, the Ibn Ezra was usually more of a person of pshat, who follows more the simple meaning of things, is the one over here that says that the rainbow is not, as the Greeks said, of natural phenomenon, but it was created especially for after the flood. It didn't exist before. And the Ramban says, no, we're forced to accept the scientific evidence that the rainbow is a natural phenomenon, and therefore, it's not that God made the rainbow to be this sign. He chose something that was natural from now on to be the sign that there wouldn't be another flood. So according to the Ibn Ezra, the sign was the rainbow itself. You don't need anything more. The fact that God created this creation was in itself the sign that there wouldn't be a flood. According to the Ramban, that this creation existed even before the flood, you have to say that the configuration of the rainbow was used as an oath, used as a sign, because of something special about what it signified. Now even the Ibn Ezra says that the rainbow, even though it existed theoretically, scientifically, before the flood, it never appeared before the flood. Why? Because in order for a rainbow to appear, you need quite a lot of conditions. And amongst those conditions is that the vapor, the water vapor, that's the rain, is not as thick, not as impervious to light. It has to let the light shine through. Then it serves as a prism. But if the clouds are too dense, right, then there won't be a rainbow. So some say that before the flood, Chazal say, the rain that happened before the flood is not as we know it. It didn't rain as often or in the way that we're familiar with rain. Before the flood, it rained once every 40 years. But when it rained, it rained. And it was a deluge. And it was enough to give the water, to give the earth enough water for the next 40 years. So the clouds were unbelievably dense. And not only that, according to others, there was a mist that permeated the atmosphere. And that's what really drenched the earth in such a way that it could remain for another 40 years. Therefore, since it only rained once every 40 years, the only time for there to be a rainbow in the clouds was once every 40 years. Because when it rained then, the clouds were so thick, dense, and there was such a mist, the sunlight couldn't come through. And therefore, that's what Ibn Ezra says. The sunlight was not strong enough to penetrate the clouds so there could be a rainbow. And some say that doesn't mean the sun changed, but it means that the conditions in the atmosphere changed that let the sunlight be much more intense than it could have been when the rainfall came before the flood. And others say that therefore the fact that there could be a rainbow after the flood showed that when it rained, it wasn't the same kind of rain that could bring a flood. The clouds aren't dense enough. There's not enough of this moisture in the air, these mists in the air. And that showed that, there wouldn't be another flood. Because the rain isn't strong enough anymore because it could permit a rainbow to be made. Obviously, the cloud cover, the mist, is not intense enough to create a flood. That's the symbol. That's the sign. The Ramban, who says that it was a natural phenomenon and could be existed even before the flood, either way, the rabbi said that the rainbow was created Erev Shabbos Ben Hashmashos. It's one of the 10 things that was created special between the physical and spiritual world. Because on the one hand, it was meant to be a spiritual sign. On the other hand, it's a physical phenomenon. So it was created Erev Shabbos Ben Hashmashos, because it's special. But not necessarily because it didn't exist until God made it a sign for the flood. It just could be that naturally it didn't have a chance to be seen. The Kliyakar says the rainbows existed in the clouds, but they weren't visible on the earth because the mist and the clouds were so intense that the rainbow could be made above the clouds but couldn't be seen on the earth. Only after the flood was the rainbow visible to human beings. The Ramban adds that the rainbow itself, even though it's a natural phenomenon, was chosen by God to be the sign that there wouldn't be a flood because it represents a bow and arrow. That's what the rainbow. A bow and arrow, in order to be destructive, has to face the arc of the arrow, has to face in the direction of what you want to destroy. rainbows always face away from the earth, never face towards the earth. That means that if you have arrows to put on that bow, they would always be shot up and never down. So it's a sign that God is not intending to destroy the world. He's turned his bow upside down. Not only that, but there was a symbol in when they fought with bows and arrows, that when you wanted to show that you wanted to make a truce, a peace treaty, you turned your bow backwards and greeted the other person with a bow that's facing towards you, which showed that you meant him no harm. So God also turned his bow backwards to show us he means us no harm. In addition, the bow has no string, so it can't shoot arrows, and there are no arrows. So three counts. It's a bow that's facing the wrong way, that has no string to put arrows on, and there are no arrows. It's an arrowless bow. All those three things, say the Rishonim, represent the idea that the rainbow is a symbol that God does not mean the world destruction. Now, and again, according to those that say that the rainbow is a natural thing, but it didn't appear before the flood because the conditions that made it possible didn't exist. Just the fact that a rainbow can appear is a sign that the rain will never be that strong that it could destroy the world. Because if it's possible for a rainbow, then the clouds aren't that intense. Now the Gemara says that the rainbow didn't appear in the generations of certain tzaddikim. It mentions Chizkiyahu, Melech Yehuda, Erev Shimon Bar Yochai. Now, if the rainbow is a natural phenomenon, how could it not appear in certain generations? And according to the Ibn Ezra, if it means that the rainbow is a natural phenomenon, but the conditions for that natural phenomenon didn't exist before the flood, it's absurd to say that in the generation of these tzaddikim, the clouds became thicker, the atmosphere became more misty, the sunlight became less intense. It's absurd. Beyond that, that's negative, not positive. So there are a few ways of understanding what that means. The Sfarno says that when the tzaddikim see the rainbow, they are incited. They are inspired to realize that God is giving a hint that the world deserves to be destroyed, but he won't destroy it because of his promise. And that way the tzaddikim start to give mussar and tochacha and daven for their generation, and that's what saves them in the end. So therefore, in the generation where there were great tzaddikim, people didn't pay attention to the rainbow because the tzaddikim themselves were enough of a protection, they didn't need the rainbow. So lo hishgichu, they didn't consider the rainbow important. They didn't need it. So they didn't pay attention to it. Not that it wasn't seen at all. They saw it. But when you don't pay attention to something, it's like you don't see it. So lo nirasa hakeshes, it didn't appear. Not that it didn't appear, it wasn't taken seriously. It wasn't needed. That's one shot. Another pshat is, and I never understood this, somebody explained to me though on Shabbos what it means. Sfarno says what I'm going to tell you now. He says it's not the rainbow that we see that is the sign that the world deserves to be destroyed. It's the double rainbow. There's rare times where there's a reflection of the original rainbow and two rainbows appear in the sky at the same time. And the second one is the inverse of the first one. In other words, instead of the colors being red, orange, yellow, they are violet, indigo, right, blue, the other way. It starts with the violet and ends with the red, instead of starting with the red and ending with the violet. And that's something that the Sfarno says has puzzled scientists till his time. He lived in the, 13 or 1400s in Italy, in the city of Sfarno. That's why he's called the Sfarno. His name was Ovadia Misfarno. The name of the city, I think, was Sparno. They used, people call them the Sipurenu or Sipurno, but it has nothing to do with the word Hebrew of Sipur. It has to do with the name of the Italian city, Sparno. So, unless the Italian city was called Sipurno, I'm not sure. I'll look it up somewhere. In any case, whatever. So he says this has puzzled scientists even to his time, and I didn't understand it. Somebody came to me and told me that that's what it is. He says under certain circumstances where the sunlight is very direct and the cloud cover is very thin, the conditions are that not only is there a rainbow, but there's a reflection of the original rainbow, and that's why it's backwards. He said, only when that double rainbow appears is it a sign that the world should have been destroyed. And therefore, there are many generations where throughout the lifetime of these great tzaddikim, the double rainbow never appeared. It anyway is a very unusual thing. It's not a regular occurrence. And that's the sign that the world deserves to be destroyed. And that taka didn't happen at all in the times of these great tzaddikim. That's one pshat. A second pshat is that, a third pshat, we said, right, one is that they didn't pay attention to it. Not that it didn't appear, they didn't pay attention, they didn't need it, because they had the tzaddikim to depend on. Second pshat is this Sfarno. The third pshat is the Hemek Dover, the Nitziv, from Valoshin. He says that the rainbow sometimes appears only momentarily in the clouds and then disappears. And sometimes it stays in the clouds for an extended amount of time. When the rainbow appears for an extended amount of time, it's a simen bracha. It's a sign of bracha. When it only appears momentarily and then disappears, then it's the sign that the world deserves to be destroyed, but because of God's promise, it won't be destroyed. That doesn't happen all the time. It happens very rarely. And in the generation of Chizkiah and of Shimon Bar Yochai and other great tzaddikim, it never happened. That it appeared only momentarily and then disappeared. If it appeared, it appeared extended time, or it didn't appear at all. Okay, in any case, I want to explain a little bit differently what the sign of the Keshis is, and to also answer the question we started out with in a deeper way. If the world will deserve to be destroyed again, then why wouldn't justice demand that it be destroyed? And if God could have mercy against that justice and not destroy a world that deserves to be destroyed, then why didn't he do it the first time? Why didn't he have mercy the first time and destroy the world? Why dafka the next time? So, based on what we said from the Beis Halevi, we can explain like this. Man's influence on the world was so strong in the beginning of creation. God created the world with chesed, tremendous kindness. Chesed usually means without boundaries. Either something very, very good without any limitations, or something very, very bad without limitations. The incest with a sister, between a sister and a brother, is called chesed because it is beyond limitation. So it's called chesed for bad. There's chesed for good. Good without limitation. That was Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu was total good, a total outpouring without boundaries and limitation. And Yitzchak had to come and go to the other extreme of gevura, of strength, of discipline, of making limitations and boundaries to balance out the chesed. Because when you don't have limitations and boundaries, it could lead to terrible things. When you have too much limitation and boundary, it could lead to terrible things. So you have to balance the two out. And that is Yaakov, who was synthesis, thank you. The synthesis between chesed and gvura was emes, Torah. That's the synthesis. In any case, before the flood, when man was created, God gave him tremendous power in this world because of chesed. God's influence to man was almost unlimited. was very intense. And because of that, man had the power to influence the entire world. What he did affected the world in a tremendously intense way. That was meant for the good, that he should elevate the world and make it more holy and bring up the animals. It could be for that reason he wasn't even allowed to eat the animals, because his way of elevating them was influencing them and raising their level from the outside. What happened? Because man utilized his power of unbridled, unlimited, unbounded influence for the bad, and instead of creating and living within the limitations that God gave him, but within those very meager limitations, having this tremendous influence that almost was unlimited, man broke down any boundaries, any limitations, and used that power for the bad. Now I'm going to tell you what I was going to say before. What did Chazal say? People were corrupt. They were corrupt monetarily. They stole from other people or whatever. But when was their judgment sealed? They were what's it called? Not only corrupt, what's the word I'm looking for? They were with Gezel, but Gilui Arayos. What's that? Sexual what?
Immorality.
Right. But it was rampant immorality. Rampant Gezel. Avodah Zarah. But you know when their judgment was sealed? The rabbis say their judgment was sealed when they started writing ksubos between men and men and women and women. They do that today. They say same-sex marriages. What's the meaning? Let me tell you what I think. What it means. And the rabbis also say, what was the chamas of the people of the flood? They didn't score out stealing from other people. Somebody would leave out a cookie pan with cookies to cool off on their windowsill. And everybody would come around and take one cookie. Now one cookie is really not worth too much. It's not even a shava pruta. And they said, what did I do? I just took one cookie. But when the guy came to get his cookies, there were none left, because everybody took one. That's like people going to the supermarket and they just want to taste one thing from the nuts or fruits or whatever. But if everybody does that, the supermarket will go broke. So you can't just look at it's only one thing. But what did they want to do? They wanted to make it legal. They wanted to make what was wrong justified. That looked okay. It was okay. Avodah Zarah, the same thing. We explained in detail at one point that the beginnings of Avodah Zarah, they felt they were doing God honor by honoring the powers that he delegated in this world. So they worshipped them or whatever. And what was this idea with Gilui Arayos? As long as the people knew they were doing something wrong, they were perverted. That's what I was looking for. Right? And they were living together, men with men and women with women, but they knew that it was perverted. There was hope. But once they started to make it legal and respectable, then there's no more hope. You know, in Miami many years ago, at least 30 years ago, when I was in Miami, so the Rabbinical Council, which I was the vice president of at the time, so my name appeared on it, came out with a protest. They wanted to legalize homosexuality in Miami. There was an ordinance that same-sex marriage, just like they have now in the country and in other countries. And the Rabbinical Council, as well as the Catholics and the Protestants, came out officially against it. And after that, I got a call once that they're reporting me to the IRS to do a... somebody who was upset, who was obviously somebody who was upset by this protest, called me. He told me, I see that you put your name on this protest, and we are calling the IRS and having them audit you. I said, please do, because I think I pay more taxes than I have to. Maybe I'll get a refund. In any case, I explained then to my kehila that it's not that we, ostracize someone who's a homosexual more than somebody who does other averus. People speak Lashon Hara, right? We don't not let a person who speaks Lashon Hara into our shuls, because otherwise the shuls will be empty. And we don't not let a homosexual come and daven in shul if he wants to. But to make a shul that is specifically for homosexuals, they had shuls like that in Miami, right? They specifically made for that. Everybody had their own little mechitza. So that's perverse, because that makes it legal. It's like making a shul. This shul is for people who speak Lashon Hara. That's absurd. This shul is for Ganavim. Right? That's making it okay. If you understand that it's wrong, it's a sickness. It's a sickness that came about, whatever. And even if homosexuality is a sickness, and it's genetic, whatever, and it's something that's there from when the person was born, that's irrelevant. You know why? Because I'll tell you the truth, that people are born with a desire for the opposite sex. And that also needs to be controlled. That also is a taiva. It's a natural taiva. But the same Rabbonus said, you can control it. So too, if people are born, unfortunately, with unnatural taivas, then they have to control them too. That's all. No different than any other taiva. So whether it's genetic or not genetic, whether it's a natural thing or not natural thing, whether it appears in nature, who cares? It appears in nature a lot of taivas. Animals have a lot of taivas. People are supposed to be people and control them. Doesn't say they don't have them. They're just supposed to control them. So, in any case, when it becomes what? That's possible to what? To control it? Yeah, a person has free choice, and if he doesn't put himself in a situation where he gives in to those tithes, or puts himself into a situation where he constantly exercises those tithes, in the beginning he can control it. Sometimes if he lets himself go, and he doesn't try to control it, it becomes out of control and uncontrollable. But since he let himself get into that matzah, he's going to be held responsible. If God knows that a person's tithes are so strong that he can't control them, he literally has no choice, then he won't be punished for that. But only God knows that. Under normal circumstances, a person should be able to control all of his tithes. And sometimes he loses control, but that's his choice, because he exercised the taiva too much. In any case, but when it becomes
legal.
Okay, legal, there's another word for it. What?
Official.
Keep going. What? Okay. That's not one word. Kosher. Yeah, that's okay. Then there's no hope. So, again, you have to have rachmonis on people who are bali aveira. You have to hate the aveira and have rachmonis on the people. And you have to, we don't have to go out and protest the fact that, you know, that there are people amongst us who are bali aveira. We have to protest the averas. We have to try to be mats of the people in tshuva. But if they want to make a parade, whose purpose is to show that this is an alternative lifestyle, this is okay, it's not only condoned, but it's justified, and it's normal, it's okay, then you have to protest. Then there's something wrong with that. And that's exactly what Chazal said brought the flood. When they started to make it legal, justify it, right? Make it normal. And start making marriages. Literally. Mamasha, Kedusha. These people, what do they care about marriage? That they're perverted people. They don't care that they live in perverted, but now they want to make it, respectable. And therefore, I'm married. Right? So then when the Avera becomes respectable, that's a problem. Because then there's no hope anymore of anybody doing tshuva. There's nothing to do tshuva about. Yeah?
Is it true that homosexuality is an avera and lesbianism is not?
No, it's not true. Homosexuality between men is a Torah prohibition that is punishable by death. Not being a homosexual just because you have a preference for men for men. That's not punishable by death. What you desire, as long as you control the desire and don't go through the action that would be a death penalty. Women is perhaps prohibited from the Torah, but not with a death penalty, just with an isser, right? It goes under the classification of Kemaisi Eretz Mitzrayim Losasu, that women physically being lesbian is Kemaisi, that's what they used to do in Mitzrayim, and the Torah prohibits that, but it's not punishable by death. And some say that it's only a rabbinic prohibition, but it's also. Okay. In any case, let's get away. That was just an example. The
why?
Why one? Because God discriminated against men. Yeah. Yeah, but that can't be true. I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's not really 100% true. Because if two women get married, they're not going to have children between themselves, right? Any more than two men are going to have children. I understand. But just the same way that a woman can impregnate herself from some kind of bank, right? So a man can do the same thing the other way around and provide for some woman to have children. So that can't be the reason why by men it's a death penalty and by women it's not. Because both of them either cannot have children in the relationship they're having, but can have children outside that relationship. So that can't be the reason. So I don't know the reason. Okay? In case you're bothered by the fact that God discriminated against some women, here's a case for God discriminated against men. Yeah. What a question? Yes.
It's interesting that there is in the political group of Israel, Hamas v'Shinui.
That? Shinui doesn't exist anymore. Well, Hamas and Shinui. I hear. Okay. Mirza Hashem, just like Shinui doesn't exist, Hamas shouldn't exist either. Okay, in any case, let's finish this. With that, you can understand how God made a promise that there wouldn't be a flood. It could be that human beings would reach the same level of evil that they reached before the flood. But after the flood, God diminished man's influence on the world. He no longer had that unlimited, unbridled influence. Therefore, he couldn't pollute the world anymore with his evil to the point where the world would have to be destroyed. People could be destroyed, but not the world. There's no reason anymore to destroy the animals, the plants, or whatever on a world scale because man's influence was limited. And that's the sign of the rainbow. What's a rainbow? You take intense white light. The white light is the conglomeration of all the colors, all the wavelengths together, and you set it through a prism that divides it into each separate thing and makes different wavelengths, different boundaries. That's the sign of why there won't be another flood. Because that intense influence, that white light that represents God's presence, because it says God's presence is similar to the rainbow. And the Malbim explains, because just like the rainbow diffuses into seven different colors, God's presence, God's Shechina, diffuses into seven different spheres, different midos, Chesed, Gvura, Tiferes, and so on. Netzach, Hod, Yesod, and Malchus, seven. Just like a rainbow, it splits the light into seven compartments, so too God's intense presence is split into seven midos, spheros. So that's the case, that's the symbol. From now on, nothing is going to be that intense. Everything is going to be divided into its compartment, into each boundary and limit. And since man's influence, since God's influence on man will not be so intense without boundaries, man's influence on the world will not be that intense without boundaries and limitations. And therefore, even if they're as evil as they were before the flood, it may be necessary to destroy those people. But it'll never come to a necessity to destroy the entire world, because man will not have that influence to pollute and contaminate the world the way that he did before. And that's exactly what the rainbow represents. That white light will never be as intense. It'll always be filtered into seven different colors. Yes. The Satan doesn't make people do sins. He just tempts them and gives them the opportunity to have free choice. Yes.
In my neck of the world, Christ has not for 20 years to be a good soul. He has no interim for anybody.
Right.
Is it possible that just how many people would it have needed to do to show?
10 people. Had to be 10 people.
Maybe because there will be, we are hoping at least, we hope for more, that there at least, you know, in this.
Could be. That's a nice idea. It could be that before the Torah was given, it was possible for people on such a large scale that there shouldn't be 10 people in the world, like by Sodom. There weren't 10 by the Mabon. But once the Torah was given, the Torah's influence is so strong that there shouldn't be 10 tzaddikim in the world is impossible. That's the power of the Torah. The only thing is that God made that promise before the Torah was given. That means between the time of the Torah and the giving of the Torah, the time of the Mabul, it couldn't have happened either. And by Sodom, that was only a localized place. There were many other tzaddikim in the world, but there weren't 10 tzaddikim in Sodom. I'm not sure. It could be after the time of Avram Avinu. It's even better. Once Avram Avinu came on the scene, his power of influence was so strong that there never could be a world without 10 tzaddikim. Could be. I like that sense idea. Yes.
Unless the topic was addressed when I was called out on an urgent matter, would Rabbi be able to summarize the reasons why one should not look at the rainbow?
It says that a person who stares at the rainbow too much is eino chas al kvod kono. He doesn't have respect for God, because the rainbow is a representation of God's presence. It's not God's presence, but it's a representation. And to stare at it too much means that you're looking at it irreverently when it represents God's presence. But that's only if you stare at it. To just look at it is okay, and you have to look at it to make the bracha.
But
it says, okay, I was going to get to that next. It says that if there's a rainbow, you shouldn't tell somebody openly there's a rainbow outside so they can come and make a bracha. You should hint to them, why don't you come outside and see what's there, because there's a matter of derech eretz, motzi dibo huksil. Someone who gives bad news is a foolish person. You never give bad news openly. You don't come and say, so-and-so died. You give a hint. So same thing over here. The rainbow is also a sign that the world really deserves to be destroyed, but God made a promise that he won't. You don't go and show off the fact that the world deserves to be destroyed. So you only hint to it that people should be able to see it and not say it openly. Yes?
Doesn't Chazal say that the world is propelled by love and love?
Right. What that means, there's many different Chazals of how many tzaddikim are in the world. It says the world never has less than 36 tzaddikim. What that means, I'm not sure. Then it says there are 10 tzaddikim, then it says there are a lot more. There's another Gemara that seems to say that it's possible there's only 2 tzaddikim in the world. But yes, there is such an idea of 36 tzaddikim. What that exactly means, I'm not sure.
Okay.